Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this first Saturday in January 2020. I'm your host, Mark Call. Now let's start to wrap up a busy New Year's holiday week with a bit of World War III preparation. You've probably heard by now, but a drone missile attack early Friday morning Iraq time killed General Qasem Soleimani, along with two other Revolutionary Guard generals, a colonel and six others from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard after they landed at Baghdad International Airport, and their entire entourage was destroyed by four American guided missiles fired from a Reaper drone. And as you might expect, Iran has vowed retaliation. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei vowed to carry out jihad against America amidst warnings of a devastating war. And all of this, as we've reported earlier, was preceded by thousands of new troops, including the 82nd Airborne Division Alert Brigade and others from Europe, along with at least 22 aircraft, having already been staged to the latest military theater in the wake of the attacks on the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. So for now, at least, the bottom line is the escalation continues. Other stories are reporting closer to home that even major leftist U.S. cities like Los Angeles and New York are on higher alert, expecting the possibility of some type of terrorist response. And given the long-standing, very porous southern U.S. border, as well as other vulnerabilities, there's no question that Iran does have Hezbollah sleeper cells already embedded within the U.S., probably with their bus tickets paid for by U.S. taxpayers. The possibility of a terrorist response or responses is very real. The threat posed, says Paul Joseph Watson, by Iran-backed Hezbollah sleeper cells embedded in major American cities has once again come to the fore following the killing of Iran's Quds Force General Qasem Soleimani. And Iran is known to have placed Hezbollah terrorist sleeper cells not only throughout Europe, but the United States as well. Last year, he notes, the criminal prosecution and conviction in New York of the Hezbollah operative Ali Qurani revealed that that terror outfit has already plotted to attack U.S. interests inside the country, and they're ready to activate if they consider the existence of either Hezbollah or Iran to be at stake. Said National Counterterrorism Center Director Nicholas Rasmussen, it's our assessment that Hezbollah is determined to give itself a potential homeland option as a critical component of its terrorism playbook. We in the intelligence community, he continued, do in fact see continued activity on behalf of Hezbollah here inside the homeland, unquote. The UK Daily Mail is reporting that the Iranian National Security Council is currently meeting in Tehran, and for the first time ever, it is chaired personally by Ayatollah Khamenei himself to consider their response. At their disposal, says the story, is the world's 13th most powerful military and a host of militia groups spread across the Middle East, including proxy forces like Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Houthi rebels, as well as allies like Bashar al-Assad of Syria. While targets in their crosshairs are likely to include U.S. troops and military bases in Iraq and Syria, Israeli forces in the Golan Heights, tankers in the Strait of Hormuz, and Saudi Arabian oil infrastructure, among other obvious options that we've already talked about. On the other war front, tensions in the continuing coup are escalating as well. In that case, Nancy Pelosi, speaker for the traitors, continues her attempt to constitutionally hijack what's left of process in the formerly free United States by holding up those articles of impeachment, well, just like they're holding up any actual evidence. Meanwhile, though, Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri has announced that if Democrats do not deliver their so-called articles of impeachment to the U.S. Senate, as is required by that, well, what is it they used to call it? Yeah, Constitution thingy. He intends to introduce a measure on Monday, January 6th, to dismiss Pelosi's slapdash articles of impeachment, basically for non-performance. Here's how he put it in a tweet, and it certainly is worth repeating. Dems said impeachment was urgent. So urgent, by the way, that they didn't even need evidence, nor an actual crime, it would seem. But now, he writes, they don't even want to have a trial because they have no evidence. In the real world, if prosecution doesn't proceed with a case, it gets dismissed. So on Monday, said the former prosecutor and attorney general from Missouri, I will introduce a measure to dismiss this bogus impeachment for lack of prosecution. This will expose the Dems' circus for what it is. A fake impeachment, abuse of the Constitution, based on no evidence. If Dems won't proceed with trial, bogus articles should be dismissed and the president fully cleared. Well, folks, at least that way they avoid any damaging, embarrassing, and probably downright humiliating testimony from the likes of the creepy Biden family, Whoremeister Comey, the shiftless one, Brennan Clapper, and the entire cast of coup plotters. So at least by next week, we can finally look forward to some actual developments. One way or another, even if it's inaction. From there, we'll back up a bit and talk about some of the most important stories of the week, more or less chronologically, starting with late last year. On Saturday night, for example, in Muncie, New York, a suburb of the city, a man stabbed five people at the home of a rabbi next to a synagogue who were celebrating Hanukkah, the latest and most violent in a string of anti-Semitic attacks in the greater New York City area over just the last few days. And true to form, it took a few days, but eventually it seems that information is trickling out that the waste stream doesn't want you to know there. We'll come back to that, but first, the attack in Texas that they really don't want you to hear about. The headline goes something like this: two innocent people were killed in addition to the wannabe mass murderer after a shooting at a worship service at the West Freeway Church of Christ in Northwest Texas. In the midst of a tragedy, anytime someone loses their life to terrorism, it's clearly a tragedy. But the good news is here, it was not, I'll repeat that again, not a gun-free killing zone, as the wannabe mass murderer found out within less than 3 seconds. Here's the rest of the story, courtesy of non-waste stream news sites like The Gateway Pundit, Cassandra Fairbanks, The Daily Caller, and others. No thanks, though, to Twitter. Around 10 a.m. during the service, after communion, the shooter, dressed in black with a hood over his head, pulled out a shotgun and almost immediately shot two people. First, an armed member of the security team, and second, one of the servers. Video of the service, streamed live at the time, showed what happened next. While most of the church members dropped to the floor and took cover behind the pews, it appears that no less than four armed Texans stood up and did what armed citizens in a free society can do: neutralized the threat by force, preventing immediately what was obviously intended to be more mass carnage. As you might expect, reports of eyewitnesses from the scene vary a bit, given the pandemonium, but the video makes it hard for even the press to deny the ultimate truth of what happened. As the Daily Caller put it, the shooting was initially captured on a live stream that's been quickly taken down. Two church members were shot, one was killed, the second died at the hospital, before a man named Jack Wilson took out the wannabe mass murderer with a single shot to the head from a distance of about 30 feet. And the fact that he was a firearms instructor and owned a shooting range no doubt helped explain his skills. Video, though, showed that at least four other armed members of the congregation drew their weapons as well during the following few seconds and helped to contain the situation without further shots being fired. Texas DPS Director Jeff Williams said the following: "The citizens who were inside that church undoubtedly saved 242 other parishioners, and that might get swept aside. It was miraculous," he said. "The true heroes in all of this are the people who were sitting in those pews today and responded. The immediate responders. It was truly heroic," unquote. Those who've been working so hard to enable this kind of carnage were quick to vomit out the usual idiocy from far left field, tweeted Beto the Banning Bolshevik immediately afterwards, quote, "So saddened to hear about another church shooting in Texas, this one in White Settlement near Fort Worth. Clearly, what we are doing in Texas, what we are doing in this country, when it comes to guns, is not working," unquote. And there's at least a bit of the Clintonian truth in there. It's not working, because now, finally, we're actually seeing places where a few armed citizens are able to fight back, and that certainly can't be permitted, and if nothing else, neither can the peons be allowed to hear the truth about it. Actual journalist Katie Pavlish, though, responded to the fake Hispanic idiocy this way, retweeting what Beto said and then correcting it thusly: "The shooter was stopped within 3 seconds, preventing further carnage by a law-abiding citizen carrying a firearm. He is a hero. You are a moron," unquote. And maybe she's being a bit too kind. Before the video is deep-sixed into the memory hole, as you might have expected, Discern.com had a chance to analyze it, noting that the actual time between the first two shots fired by the shotgun-wielding assailant until it was all over was about 2.5 seconds. But the video showed that Jack Wilson was actually beginning to pay attention to the situation even slightly before the masked man actually pulled out his weapon. There was even a bit of good news in the national coverage. I was surprised to see ABC News reporter from Los Angeles actually come up and say, "Today, good people with guns stopped a bad one with a gun." But I was particularly encouraged to see the Tarrant County, Texas Sheriff, Bill Wayborn, say the following:
"Today, evil walked boldly among us. And let me remind you, good people raised up and stopped it before it got worse.
And furthermore, it's pretty obvious that there are a whole lot of good people in Texas giving thanks today to the real source of their salvation. We'll follow that up with a story that I said we'd get back to, and we will now. The anti-Semitic attack against a bunch of Jews gathered for Hanukkah at a home of a rabbi in Muncie, New York. Even New York's Bolshevik governor could recognize that one for what it was. Said the ever quick to grab some attention Governor Andrew Cuomo, the stabbings were an act of domestic terrorism, quote, spurred by hate. Gee, do you think? What stunning insight. The trouble is, there's a whole lot of stuff that the press didn't feel compelled or even interested in reporting. They told us the name, Grafton E. Thomas, and the fact that the guy had been arrested. He had a record, too. Turns out he was arrested a while back for punching a police horse. But they weren't really anxious to show pictures. Rest assured, though, if he had been a white supremacist, we would have heard about that. As a matter of fact, I did hear the attack being blamed on white supremacism, even though this guy turns out to be black. But wait, there's more. As Mike Cernovich pointed out, the Socialist Propaganda Liars Club, or SPLC, oh so politically correct, even 2 days after the attack on Hasidic Jews, didn't feel it was worth mentioning. As Paul Joseph Watson observed, it obviously doesn't fit the narrative. But more interestingly, perhaps, jihadwatch.org, in what they admit is a preliminary report subject to further follow-up, which did in fact get confirmed by other independent sources before the weekend, if not necessarily the three-letter ministries of propaganda, says they have a highly credible law enforcement source telling them that the Muncie stabbing attack suspect, Thomas E. Grafton, is a recent convert to, well, folks, the religion of peace. And if what we've been seeing from Europe is any guide, when it comes to reporting, that'll be the end of that. Much of the rest of the news for the new year looked a lot like some of the really disgusting news, though, from the old year. And so far, folks, it's fair to say the only thing that's really 2020 about this year is hindsight. Because at least when it comes to conspiracy theories, and perhaps dystopian novels and movies, too, just about everyone I can think of has now been proven true. Big Ag, Big Pharma, and Big Brother three-letter agencies really do want to see you dead. Literally everybody that hasn't been Greta Thunberg into a stupor by now knows that man-made global warming is a farce. Still, though, that doesn't mean chemtrails aren't very real and certainly trying to muck up the weather. Hitlery and Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, most of the seventh floor of the FBI, and the deep state that runs them really are a bunch of crooks. And the Mueller farce, followed by the impeachment farce, soon to be followed by the 25th Amendment farce, and when that fails, almost certainly an attempt to kill this president, again, by any means necessary, and that'll include mass casualties if they need to, are thus almost a lead pipe cinch when it comes to 2020 hindsight being applied as foresight this year. All right, well, having said all of that, folks, I'm going to launch into the new year with a story that, admittedly, I've seen several times over the last few days from multiple sources, and quite frankly, the first several times it didn't even raise an eyebrow. So it's fair to ask, why am I bothering with it? Well, when it comes to predictions to start the new year, and of course predictive programming, I'm going to suggest that this one really raises the question that people need to ponder right up front. First, the story, and you'll see what I mean. Virginia legislature, sick, and yeah, sick Virginia legislature works too, held a budget hearing on gun confiscation and all kinds of wonderful associated things like red flag laws and probably mortuary subsidies on Thursday this week, January 2nd. The announcement said the new socialist gun-banning legislature was going to hold hearings on Governor Blackface Northam's anti-gun budget in four locations. Guess how red they are, and no, I don't mean Republican, folks. I mean truly communist, around the state on Thursday. And as you've no doubt heard by now, the treasonous governor and legislature is supporting an abomination called SB 16, which would not only ban commonly owned firearms in over a million Virginia households, it's almost certainly at least intended to cause an uprising. And the Constitution-burning flap has already encouraged 90 Virginia counties, via one mechanism or another, to voice their support for the Constitution and Bill of Rights as written and become Second Amendment sanctuary counties. In short, battle lines are being drawn, and the stories say the governor is requesting more money, in theory at least from the very people that he intends to kill, to finance the upcoming civil war. Governor Blackface has asked for 18 new law enforcement, sick, positions and $4 million to enforce the unconstitutional gun ban, and furthermore, the governor is asking for another $3.5 million to enforce gun control that hasn't even yet been passed by the communist legislature and isn't even, well, current law, and of course, if we actually had a rule of law, could never be in Virginia. Things like universal background checks, which means you must have permission, you pee on you, to buy or sell, one gun a month limits and so-called red flag gun confiscation orders, and a whole bunch more stuff that they'll no doubt make up as they go along, and perhaps as the body bags accumulate. Well, we're certainly all thinking by now, none of this is any kind of a surprise. So what's the question you were alluding to, Mark? Ah, Grasshopper, I'm glad you asked. Well, let's pause here for a second and think about it, folks. Ask yourself this question. Here are a bunch of traitors who could care less about the oath they took before God to preserve and protect and defend a constitution, both of the state of Virginia and these United States, against enemies like them of the domestic variety. They're even brazen enough to chide honest, oath-abiding sheriffs and county commissioners who say, hey, we're not going to violate our oaths, much less get people killed supporting unconstitutional things that are actually no law at all. So here's the question, folks, for these so-called lawmakers that are going through the public charade of approving a budget to gang rape the rule of law. Why bother? You don't care about prohibitions against theft, obviously, so why not just steal the money, too? And you're willing to kill people to come and take their stuff, or at least send somebody else to die in your place and try to steal it for you. So here's the question that ought to be asked today. Who are you kidding? How stupid do you think people are? And for crying out loud, what has a budget got to do with anything when you're so willing to literally trash the entire remainder of the rule of law and rub it in people's faces? The only thing I can think of, folks, that comes close to this level of absurdity is when the communist Chinese government executes somebody for some so-called crime like Virginia is now trying to put in place, you know, not being a good communist, and then sends a bill to the survivors of the family for the bullets used to execute their loved one. All of which should, of course, inspire one more important question today, too. Not only why bother and who are they kidding, but what's the real point of this latest farce, since it certainly looks like yet another beta test? In other words, just how far are they really willing to go? And pardon my bluntness, folks, but there's no polite way to put what they're doing, to truly piss Virginians off. Let's follow that up with a story that, in hindsight, looks like it ought to provide some foresight from France. A story that's been ignored by most media outlets concerning car torchings by the Religion of Peace. Although French media no longer reports on the mass New Year's Eve car torching, says bare-naked Islam, citizen journalists with cell phones are taking up the slack. Strasbourg, France, among others, has turned into an apocalyptic dystopia as literally hundreds of cars were set ablaze on New Year's Eve. Police, it says, have not disclosed just exactly how many cars were torched, but a source told AFP that the figure was larger than the previous year, which was pretty impressive on its own. A number of arrests and some minor injuries have also been reported, and the burning of vehicles has become an unfortunate New Year's Eve tradition in Muslim migrant strongholds in France. According to local media, 1,031 vehicles were set alight nationwide on the night of December 31, 2018, compared with 935 the previous New Year's Eve. And in a twisted sort of way, that makes sense if you realize the communists in power don't want people to have private cars anyway. And while we're on the subject of stories with multiple sources that provide 2020 foresight, based on obvious 2020 hindsight, let's go here next. The piece I'm looking at comes courtesy of Daisy Luther at the Organic Prepper, but a whole lot of the alternative web has tuned into this one. She calls it yet another crazy conspiracy theory that turns out, of course, to be true. The United Nations is hiring in New York, no surprise there, but what are the positions they're looking to fill? English-speaking disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration officers. They call it DDR nowadays because everything's got to have an acronym, especially if it points towards war. And no doubt there's quite a few East German Stasi that could qualify for the job, depending upon their English proficiency. The job was posted the day after Christmas. So, for both of those people who are still trying to insist nobody wants to take your guns, here's a job offering you might want to consider. The DDR, or Disarmament, Demobilization, and Reintegration, Achtung officer, will be responsible for the following duties. act as a focal point for the disarmament and other DDR components for 2 to 3 missions, responsible for planning, support to implementation, and evaluation. I guess that means counting body bags. Participate in DPO and Integrated Task Force planning meetings for the establishment of a new peacekeeping SIC mission with a potential DDR component. And do you see why beta tests like Virginia are so important? And provide technical assistance to the so-called peace negotiations. Peace through terror. Advise, develop, and review initial DDR functional strategy and concept of operations for further development into a full program by the DDR component. Und the Achtung National DDR Commission draft und review DDR inputs to Secretary General report, code tables, und talking points. Provide headquarters support in planning the civilian und military logistics support for DDR. Jawohl. Eventually you will have guns und sie won't. And you get the picture, but there are a whole lot of other references to DDR and how important it is to Big Brother's coming disarmament missions. Continues Daisy Luther, since President Trump officially removed the United States from the absolutely anti-constitutional UN Arms Trade Treaty last year, and Congress never ratified the abomination anyway, it is fair to ask, she says, why the UN might be looking for English-speaking disarmament experts in pretty much already pre-disarmed New York City. And furthermore, since a number of Virginians appear to have no plans to give up their guns or register them, and they do remember the shot heard around the world that kicked off the Revolutionary War to boot, and there are at least some indications that the National Guard might object to firing on fellow Virginians, maybe it's increasingly obvious why the UN might be looking for disarmament officers. One thing, though, is really obvious now in hindsight. It never was about so-called common-sense gun laws, because there hasn't been any common sense involved in the gang rape of the Bill of Rights for a long, long time. And speaking of common sense, or the lack thereof, and a potential flashpoint, this one from Richard Moorhead at Big League Politics is pretty interesting. Some members, he says, of the Jewish community in that particular area, after the most recent set of attacks, have begun to openly arm themselves. The article includes cell phone pictures attached to tweets. Says the story, members of New York's Orthodox Jewish community were seen openly carrying AR rifles, wow, folks, at a community event on Sunday. A day after, that man attacked a rabbi's home in Muncie with a machete and sent 5 people to the hospitals with severe injuries. Another attack occurred in New Jersey earlier this month at a Jewish grocery store where 4 people were killed, and the attack specifically targeting members of New York City's Jewish community appear to have motivated at least some of them to arm themselves in self-defense. The problem, of course, is that New York has some of the most Orwellian anti-constitutional gun control policies in the country, and more folks are questioning whether the men's rifles were legal under the state's abominable laws, because open carry is heavily restricted in New York, and it's a shame, says the piece, that some of the men may end up being afoul of the state's bogus gun control laws in an environment where it appears some members of the general public are inclined to target Jews. Even though it might be difficult to imagine that New York prosecutors would go after the men, given the recent spate of attacks, if they did, more and more Jews who wish to arm themselves in self-defense might feel they're left with no choice other than to move to a state where the Constitution is still recognized, especially after what happened in Texas. The trouble, of course, is that the way things are going, especially with beta tests like Virginia already demonstrating what the intent is, there are fewer and fewer states left for people who've actually read the Constitution to move to. And if the Congress gets their way, pretty soon there won't be any. Let's slip this quick story in before the bottom of the hour break. From late last year, a whooping cough outbreak has forced a school in Houston, Texas, to close early. Prior to the year-end Christmas break, the school, St. Teresa's Catholic School in Memorial Park, will be closed until next week, and the outbreak affected not only students but staff. What's the punchline? Well, according to Fox News, officials at the Archdiocese said that 100% of the students who attend the Catholic school have been vaccinated against this very illness, which says something at least concerning the oft-mandated claim that vaccines are 100% safe and effective, except when they're not. In which case, you better just pull a Sergeant Schultz if you want to stay on Facebook.
Oh, I see nothing. I was not here. I did not even get up this morning.
Oh.
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening, this first Saturday of 2020. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and no doubt about it, so far at least, 2020 is starting out like a year where it's hindsight we're talking about, because so many things that we're still dealing with have not only been building for a very long time, but in hindsight, certainly could have been avoided, especially, for example, if we still had a rule of law or people of integrity in the Congress or various three-letter bureaucracies laughably called federal law enforcement and the like. Which leads me to this story to set the second half stage. As a general rule, folks, your host isn't real big on these end-of-the-year recaps of the most important, least important, etc., etc. stories for the previous year, or even, in this case, the previous decade. But I am willing to make an occasional exception, especially when it comes to bogus science revealed as such. Which leads me to an interesting brief video from the Heartland Institute about a decade of full-on climate alarmist strikeouts, 2010 through 2019. I won't try to go through them all, but let's start with this one. James Hansen of NASA predicted back in 1988 that by 2020, and hey, global temperatures would be 4 to 6 degrees warmer than in 1958. How about this one? Guardian columnist George Monbiot predicted that global famine would occur by 2012 unless the entire planet went vegan. Instead, and even NASA's admitting this, what with more CO2 in the atmosphere, which plants need to live, global crop production, says the piece, has increased steadily. Several so-called researchers, including the notorious now billionaire as a result of the lies, Al Gore, that predicted an ice-free Arctic by, well, any time now, including over the last 10 years, wrong again. The not-so-bonnie Prince Charles predicted way back in 2009 that we had just 8 years left to save the planet. That one expired in 2017, and again, wrong. In 1988, the United Nations predicted that the Maldives Islands would be completely underwater by now. You can still book a flight there and enjoy your time. And interestingly, they didn't mention it, evidently because it's old news by now. People like Al Gore and alarmists like the entire Obama regime have been talking about all kinds of beachfront properties that would be underwater by now, while they keep stocking up on them, I guess at reduced prices to boot. And mostly, too, come to think of it, while they fly their private jets around the world to various climate science retreats, burning lots and lots of booga 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 carbon fuels in the process, they plot new ways to deprive you of not only the right to air condition your beachfront property, or have it, but even heat your home during the coming longer global solar minimum-induced winters. So I guess it's fair to ask again, as this year comes to an end, who you gonna believe? Those who've been caught lying to you again and again and again and again as they suck at the public teat, or those who can read history and recognize cycles that seem to repeat again and again and again. Which means this next item fits nicely here from, ironically, Vladimir Putin, who seems compelled to have to remind the West that those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it. And on several occasions, as the year drew to a close, Putin responded to what he's called the dangerous revival of fascism sweeping across Europe by calling out most recently the Polish ambassador to Germany, Joseph Lipsky, between 1934 and 39, who was, quote, scum and an anti-Semitic pig. There's no other way of describing him. He shared Hitler's anti-Semitic sentiment, and moreover, he promised to erect a monument in Warsaw for the persecution of the Jewish people, unquote. He's concerned about full-spectrum dominance under the military-industrial utopians of NATO and the American deep state. And he reminded his listeners that true blame for World War II should be found among those European powers that had already created non-aggression pacts with Hitler long before Russia got involved, beginning with the 1938 Munich Agreement between France, England, and Germany that allowed them to carve up Czechoslovakia. It's people like those, he said, who were negotiating with Hitler and who are today tearing down monuments to liberating warriors that, of course, included the Red Army. Notes Matthew Arrett for the Strategic Culture Foundation. Let's not forget the same Wall Street and City of London banksters which today are pushing for a global fascist world government enthusiastically poured fortunes into fascist war coffers during the decade preceding World War II. On so many fronts here, folks, the parallel should not be ignored. And that seems to go for so much of the news this first week in the new year, whether we're talking about gun bans and Nazi attempts to confiscate firearms, or, of course, the fascist public-private partnerships between Big Brother and big corporate partners like Gulag, to Facebook, Twitter, and so many others that call themselves private but still seem to dip at the public trough and not only want to monitor everything you think, speak, and say, but control it to boot. Speaking of which, over the weekend there were any number of reports from multiple sources about how the president is being, again, shadow banned by Twitter. They blamed a computer glitch, said one story from Zero Hedge, after President Trump's retweet of a post containing the name of the man who shall not be named, alleged whistleblower Eric Sharamella, mysteriously disappeared from his timeline. But, says Tyler Durden, after fixing the issue and restoring the tweet, well, allegedly, so some folks could see it, the user was simply banned from the platform so that nobody could see the tweet, which then went viral. Twitter blames technical difficulties. I think the technical difficulties, though, were the fact that they ever managed to allow the tweet to be retweeted in the first place and didn't shut the president down before anybody even saw it. On a related front, creepy Joe Biden's message of get it while you can and then you get to be president isn't resonating with even far-left voters at a Joe Biden event on Sunday at a New Hampshire middle school gymnasium. Not one but two protesters interrupted quid pro Joe with accusations of being a pervert. And can you believe this? Making money in Ukraine. Here's what one of them said, quote, "You've touched kids on video and women," shouted the man, adding, "We don't need another old white man running for president." So he's obviously a good politically correct Democrat, at least on other fronts. Time, he continued, to have a minority candidate. To which Biden, who may or may not have actually understood what the guy was saying, he may still be creepy, but he left cogent a long time ago, said, "I agree with you, man. I agree. Nice talking with you." The man that wasn't done, "Don't ever touch kids again," he continued. "Don't touch kids, you pervert." To which Biden shook his head. The man then told the gasping crowd, "Look it up. Don't lie to them, creepy Uncle Biden. Look it up." He was met with a smattering of half-hearted applause from the less-than-energized crowd, says the Zero Hedge summary, and that was followed up by another man in the back who finally shouted at Biden, "Excuse me, Mr. Biden, how much money did you make in Ukraine?" Prompting quid pro Joe to shoot back, "Wait, wait, wait, I released 21 years of my tax returns. Your guy hasn't released one. What's he hiding?" As if anybody who points out corruption must somehow be on Team Trump. Which also says a whole lot about the agenda here. Dr. Ron Paul, former congressman from Texas and presidential candidate, asked an interesting question this week in his column for the Ron Paul Institute, "Should racists get health care?" And of course, it all depends on who gets to define what a racist is, doesn't it? Political correctness, he says, recently took a dangerous turn in the United Kingdom when the North Bristol National Health Service Trust announced that hospital patients who use, well, what they call offensive racist or sexist language will cease receiving medical care as soon as they decide it's safe to end their treatment. The condition that treatment will not be withdrawn until doing so is safe seems to imply, says Dr. Paul, that no one will actually suffer from this policy. However, healthcare providers, especially in the socialist UK, have great discretion to determine when it's safe to withhold treatment. So, he says, patients could be left with chronic pain or be denied certain procedures that could improve their health but are not necessary to make them what they call safe. Patients accused of racism or sexism could also find themselves at the bottom of the NHS's infamous waiting list, unable to receive treatment until it truly is a matter of life and death. And since, he writes, a lot of folks, especially on the far left nowadays, define racism and sexism as anything I disagree with, the new policy will no doubt lead to people being denied medical care for statements that most reasonable people would consider unobjectionable. And he notes this isn't the first time NHS has decided to withhold treatment because of an individual's behavior. A couple of years back, another local health committee announced they'd withhold routine or non-emergency surgeries from smokers and people that are obese.
And since, writes Dr. Paul, reducing smoking and obesity arguably benefits both individual patients and the healthcare system as a whole, this policy might appear defensible. But, says Dr. Paul, MD, who has taken the oath, denying or delaying medical care violates ethics and sets a dangerous precedent. If treatment could be denied to smokers and the obese, well then why not to those who engage in promiscuous sex, drive over the speed limit, or don't get the proper number of vaccinations for themselves or their children, or if they have dangerous political views. And yeah, we all knew he was properly headed here. Government bureaucrats denying care to individuals for arbitrary reasons is the inevitable result of government interference in what was once a free market for health care. And let's not forget that it's all about rationing, which he notes has been part of the American health care socialist plan since at least the passage of the Health Maintenance Organization Act way back in 1973. Every plan to expand government's role in health care, writes Dr. Paul, contains some form of rationing. The big question, of course, is how to do it and who gets to make the choice.
But that's not what's worrying me. It's how to do it. These things must be done delicately, or you hurt the staff.
Writes Dr. Paul, claiming that government officials know how medical treatment can best enhance quality of life, well, at least for those that they want to live at all, is as absurd as claiming that government officials know the correct prices of automobiles. And he said it before, but doesn't say it here, I will, or the correct price for money, or even what it is. Well, one thing's for sure, though, they're back to printing a whole lot of it these days. Said a piece from Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge on the first business day of the new year, helicopter money is here, and here is how the Fed monetized billions in debt sold just days earlier. Now, there's lots of charts and graphs in this one, so we'll stick to the high points. The Fed's charter, they begin, prohibits it from directly purchasing bonds or bills issued by the U.S. Treasury. Well, who cares about charters anymore, right? We're in a post-constitutional world now. Anyway, that process is also known as monetization, and various Fed chairs have repeatedly testified under oath, as if that mattered, to Congress that the Fed doesn't do that. Of course, the alternative is what's known as helicopter money, as helicopter Ben Bernanke famously pointed out, where the central bank directly purchases bonds issued by the Treasury and forms the backbone of the MMT, Modern Monetary Theory, cult. But what if, they ask, there's a several-day interval between Treasury issuance and the subsequent purchase? Well, that's perfectly legal, and it's something the Fed's done not only during QE1, QE2, and QE3, but is continuing to do now as part of, well, not QE, a.k.a. QE4. The nitty-gritty here has to do with what's called POMOs, or maybe repos, permanent open market operations, liquidity injections, basically where they issue bills and then flip them back, well, at least some of them. And sometimes, it seems, dealers get to pocket some of the unspecified markup the Fed generously provides to them just because they're dealers. Not the kind you're thinking about, but they're just as bad. Bottom line, says the story, the Fed is already conducting helicopter money and MMT. They just don't call it that, and it seems they're not particularly wild about anybody else calling it what it really is, either. Another look next at the theme of 2020 hindsight. A nice piece from Ryan McMakin at the Mises Institute says 2019 was a bad year for the bogus narrative only cops should be allowed to have guns. Because on December 29th, as you may have heard, especially if you listen to the alternative media, like this show, an armed gunman entered the West Freeway Church of Christ in Texas that turned out to not be a gun-free killing zone, shot two members of the congregation dead with a shotgun, but within a total elapsed time of about 6 seconds, a third member of the congregation drew a weapon and shot the wannabe continuing mass murderer dead via a headshot. The events were captured on live stream video, and the dramatic turn, in the mind of many observers at least, highlighted the benefits of privately owned firearms as a constitutional defense against the kind of people that the left is encouraging to go out and do deeds like this. Moreover, the fact that the gunman had a criminal history, obtained his gun illegally, which demonstrated yet one of the many pitfalls of the gun control narrative, namely, that those with criminal intent can be so easily restrained by a few bogus anti-constitutional laws. Nevertheless, he says many media outlets were unable to bring themselves to even admit that privately owned firearms, in this case, were the key to preventing a far wider massacre.
because nobody really knows how many more would have been killed had an armed response not been present. And furthermore, if the congregants had awaited for the police to arrive, even if they'd come quickly, it's not clear how they would have engaged the shooter or even known who was the right person to engage. Those considerations, though, are still not sufficient to divert so much of the waystream left-leaning media from their insistence that, oh, peons shouldn't be allowed to own guns anyway. Case in point, Elvia Diaz at the Arizona Republic, who highlighted her ignorance via the following. Concerning the man who took out the wannabe mass murderer, she wrote, "The reality of Wilson's heroism is a lot more complex. He wasn't just an ordinary parishioner, as gun advocates may want you to believe. The church's volunteer security team member is a firearms instructor, gun range owner, and former reserve deputy with the local sheriff's department, according to a detailed account in the New York Times. In other words, she finally admits he's exactly the kind of man you want around with a firearm, or folks, as a neighbor, or a member of your church. He's exactly the kind of person we should have been training in the schools, and indeed used to, back when we had a rule of law. But listen to this. She says, we know nothing about the at least six other parishioners who also appeared to draw their handguns at the West Freeway Church of Christ in White Settlement, Texas. Now, here's the irony. She knows nothing about almost anything associated with the law, self-defense, or much less guns. And she concludes, I guess for all of us, that's terrifying. Because what these people don't know and don't bother to find out really is terrifying. So who are they to decide whether you should be allowed to exercise your God-given rights in the first place? Well, says McMakin, to many people who aren't ignorant far-left journalists, it's hardly terrifying that other private citizens of unknown expertise, especially by them, and certainly relative to their low standards, were armed in the congregation. But do note that none of those people ever fired a shot once they saw the shooter had been incapacitated. And yet, he notes, 2019 has provided any number of reminders as to what sort of expertise and so-called heroism government-provided security forces offer. From scores upon scores of dead family pets, to innocent people caught in crossfire, to, of course, innocent women literally shot because they were in the wrong place, maybe like their own home, at the wrong time. In the spring of 2019, he writes, the parents of the victims of the Parkland gun-free killing zone mass murder sued the Broward County School Board and the Sheriff's Office for failing to take timely action against the alleged lone gunman shooter there from February 2018. According to the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, police officers repeatedly sought to protect themselves rather than the victims inside the school, and an analysis of communications among law enforcement officers at the site of the massacre confirmed there were, quote, at least two times a Broward deputy urges another officer to protect themselves, not confront the killer, unquote. And if anything, folks, other stories have pointed out the facts were even more damning than that. Meanwhile, 2019 provided a number of reminders that police officers will shoot citizens dead in their own homes for no justifiable reason, as was the case, for example, of Atiana Jefferson on October 12th. According to multiple accounts, the shooter, now thankfully former cop Aaron Dean, entered Jefferson's private property unannounced in the middle of the night, whereupon he peered into Jefferson's windows, and within seconds, the officer had shot Jefferson dead while she was playing video games with her nephew. Similar cases abound. For example, October, when former police officer Amber Geiger was sentenced to 10 years for unlawfully shooting Bothan Jean in his own apartment. At the time, Geiger was a police officer returning home from work, whereupon she entered the wrong apartment and promptly shot the man, the actual lawful resident there, dead. So, he concludes, if there's anything that ought to be terrifying to ordinary Americans, other than obvious things like traitors in Virginia or the floor of the House of Representatives, it's not the idea that some law-abiding citizens might actually have constitutionally protected God-given rights to keep and bear arms. The far more terrifying thought should instead be the knowledge that some police officers are so eager to murder residents in their own living rooms. And they kill dogs so often that doesn't even seem to get reported much anymore except locally. He does quote the usual statistics that, when honestly examined, reveal the constitutionally clear truth. As former University of Chicago professor John Lott once famously put it in a book by the same name, more guns, less crime. If you look at net increases in total U.S. guns over the last few years, we find that new gun production increased from around 4.5 million back in 1998 to more than 12 million in 2017. And over that same period, homicide rates decreased from 6.3 to 5.3 per 100,000. And in fact, after years of rising gun production, the U.S. homicide rate has now fallen to a 50-year low since 2014, which doesn't, of course, prove that more guns mean less crime, but it's yet another of basically all of the statistics that, honestly examined, point in that same direction. Like, for example, the states with the least restrictive anti-constitutional gun control laws are also among those with the lowest homicide rates and, indeed, lower crime rates overall, especially when it comes to things with obvious correlations, like home invasions, rapes, and similar crimes where perps logically fear an armed response. Says Ryan McMacken, "There's no denying the optics this year were bad for the pro-gun control folks, because faced with the option of owning a gun for protection or trusting in police for that protection, more and more people, especially those that understand history, economics, and, yeah, human nature, and for that reason, the Bill of Rights, are opting to choose self-defense and a firearm as opposed to dial 911 and die." From there we go back to Europe, which has already tread the totalitarian road farther than America will hopefully ever go, at least if we're paying attention, so it certainly remains to be seen. This time courtesy of a piece from the Gatestone Institute's Søren Kern about Europe, where anti-Christian attacks reached an all-time high in 2019. There's a shocker. The anti-Christian hostility begins as sweeping across Western Europe, and during 2019, Christian churches and symbols were deliberately attacked literally day after day. For that reason, the Gatestone Institute reviewed thousands of newspaper reports, police blotters, parliamentary inquiries, socialist media posts, and specialized blogs from Britain, France, Germany, Ireland, Italy, and Spain. And the research shows, and there's about a dozen pages of appendices to make the point, that roughly 3,000 Christian churches, schools, cemeteries, and monuments were vandalized, looted, and/or defaced, and/or defecated and urinated upon in Europe during 2019, which is on track, and the numbers aren't quite all in yet, and you can guess why, to becoming a record year for anti-Christian sacrilege on the continent. Violence against Christian sites is most widespread in France, where churches, schools, cemeteries, and monuments are being vandalized, desecrated, and burned at an average rate of about 3 per day, according to government statistics. Germany is a little bit more enlightened, only 2 per day there. And furthermore, the perps of these anti-Christian attacks are rarely caught, and when they are, police and media generally censor the information about their identities, ethnic backgrounds, and, say it with me folks, religious proclivities. And because the claim is that many of the suspects are said to have mental disorders, that's an interesting way to put it, isn't it? As a result, many anti-Christian attacks are not characterized as hate crimes. And maybe that's just a bit more palatable than telling people it's political correctness run amok. Writing for the Spanish newspaper ABC, Juan Pedro Quinonero, its Paris correspondent for more than 35 years, put it this way. "The desecrations have an evident anti-Christian character. Drunk with fierce hatred, the vandals want to give their actions a clear anti-religious dimension. In recent months, anti-Semitic gangs have desecrated Jewish cemeteries, signing their actions with swastikas. And in the case of the desecration of Catholic churches, vandalism isn't signed. It simply speaks for itself. Heinous mockeries of the figure of Christ on the cross and the desecration of high altars." Likewise, though, says Kern, "the European media outlets, which tend to amplify attacks on Muslims, have tended to downplay malicious attacks against Christianity. To the point where the French newspaper Le Monde has even disputed the government's use of the term anti-Christian acts and warns politicians not to instrumentalize the issue. Can we really, they ask, speak of profanations, a strong term, which implies an attack on the sacredness of a place of worship?" Which evidently means if Le Monde doesn't say it's sacred, you can't hardly profane it now, can you? Well, as I mentioned, the article ends with an appendix that runs to over a dozen pages, breaking down the attacks by nation and into categories. Things like suspicious fires at churches in 2019, attacks on Christian historic sites, cemetery desecrations, urination, defecation et al., attacks on nativity scenes, and outright Satanism, and etc. in the form of vandalism. And while those are themes I'm sure we'd prefer to see in the rearview mirror, here's an easy prediction for 2020. Don't count on it.